Hi there, I'm Nicole Swanson, and welcome to Forza Tutti, the podcast by Zircon Arts, where we explore the power of creativity and collaboration at the intersection of the arts, education, public policy, and social justice. The episode you're about to hear was recorded in December 2024 with guest Jenny Boughton. Jenny plays flute and piccolo in the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, and also has a few other roles that you'll hear about in this conversation. On with the show. Why don't we start with, you know, the warm-up questions and just tell us a little bit about your background, perhaps some meaningful teachers along the way, for better or for worse, maybe some key experiences that kind of propelled you to where you are today.
Well, I think I would have to start my list of meaningful experiences at the beginning. My dad is a professional musician as well, and he was my first flute teacher, although for anybody who is a parent of a child and has tried to teach them something, it can be tough to be on either side of that dynamic. I think the thing that I learned right away from him as a young child, before I had any, you know, interest in music as a career at all. And if anything, I had a disinterest in music as a career because, you know, kids want to be different than their parents. Okay. I just saw him come home every night. He was a jazz musician, and he taught at a university. And then he also did a lot of pit orchestra work as a doubler, and still does. But I would see him come home every night, and he was just delighted. He loved going to work. He loved coming home from work. He always had funny stories about people in the pit. And so he just seemed like he was having so much fun. He just loved playing. You know, there were many days when he would be responsible for getting my sister and I off to school. And it was a real free range childhood because dad was practicing, which I now completely get. The need for that, that you have to take care of that part of yourself, even when you're caring for other people. So I just observed and absorbed the joy of making music and making sound, and the idea of that, you know, playing an instrument is that creative exploration that is similar to the way that children explore the world. And especially as a jazz musician and an improviser, there was a lot of freedom. And the way he interacted with his students was also like that. There was a lot of laughter in the lessons and, you know, good-natured teasing. And the kids, college students, they responded really well to being treated as an equal, but also like with a degree of authority that wasn't coming from an authoritarian place, which I think, you know, there are so many different styles of teaching. So I've had all of those also in my own life, but that was the main lesson, was just that this is a fun way to live. And, you know, there was no discussion of whether or not it was a great way to make money, because we were fine, and it was fine. You know, it worked out. And, he would say things like, "Well, just live the way you want to live and then figure out a way to make the money after the fact," which is, I think, a real freelancer attitude as well. You know, just like take the gigs. Didn't always mean he was available for things at night, pretty much never. You know, he was always working at night. But that was very formative. And then when he became my flute teacher, the whole dynamic shifted, because that is, it's, you know, anybody who had to do homeschooling during COVID can relate to how the way that a parent can explain something that's very obvious or familiar to their own child is, it puts you outside of this frame of familiar parent speak.
Right.
And it you don't even realize that you're like crossing over, but the kid is suddenly freaked out and insulted and hurt, and just, it's drama. So that was how that went. And
so how long did that last?
A few years. I mean,
oh, okay.
He was also not, I'm saying this with like a ton of respect and admiration because I'm not good at teaching beginners myself.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not equipped to teach a beginner.
It
He,
does take a special kind of skill set.
yeah, it was like, here are the notes, here's a flute, you know, Bach sonata. Like it was very A to Z quickly. And so that led to some frustration on both sides. At the same time, I never, you know, it's a gap in my own process of learning that I can't really share with my students is I don't know any beginner repertoire. I don't know what the easiest pieces are for the flute. And pretty much like the milestone that motivated me to get better, there were two things. I started playing in band. In 7th grade, we just moved, and the school that we moved, the school district that we changed into, those kids had started band like a few years prior. And I hadn't started band at my old school because I wasn't interested in playing the flute at all. But I had to choose an elective really quickly, and it was just like, God, I guess, fine, I'll do this. And we went to a pawn shop and got a flute for probably like a really 50 bucks. I mean, like, I don't know. Really, it was a bargain basement kind of instrument. I knew how to play B flat, and I went into the band, and that was the note that I played, like just at random interval. Which now I realize is probably fairly common at many levels. But I felt exposed and vulnerable, and so I figured I don't like this feeling. I better practice, and then at least I'll know what I'm doing, and I won't feel like I'm faking quite so much. And then from that point, then I really wanted to get my ears pierced. And so my dad told me that if I could play Yaesu, Joy of Man's Desiring on the flute, I could get my ears pierced. And I remember looking at like
Not
those.
where I thought that was going at all, and I love that that was like
Oh,
the
yeah. 3 pages of triplets. It seemed impossible. And I don't even know if I actually did accomplish that task. I think I just probably did a little tweeny fit and got my ears pierced anyway. Those were some moments that, like, you know, then once you start to get a little better, then you realize, oh, this there's can be some other benefits to this besides getting your ears pierced. You can enjoy making music. So he was and continues to be a huge influence, and my favorite duet partner, hands down. Just every holiday, every visit, we play flute duets, and it's my favorite.
I love that.
It's really great. It's really great. And it got so much better after he wasn't my teacher anymore,
Of
because then
course.
we could relate about music and not fight about music. And then, you know, then my both of my college professors, Marina Piccinini at the Peabody Conservatory and Jeannie Backstresser at Carnegie Mellon, were incredible and very different. I've heard it said that, you know, that different stages of life require a different type of teacher, and that kind of this middle stage, which would have been my undergraduate, you really need somebody who's going to drill down, and it's either you can survive the difficult growth of that phase, or your life will go in a different direction, and that's okay too. So it was a very, very hard time. That transition was very hard for me, but I learned so much. And then when I went to grad school, it was more nurturing and more preparatory for, you know, professional level playing and auditions, and I find myself using both of their philosophies in my own teaching a great deal. And I was surprised recently. I went back to Peabody. I hadn't seen Marina in years, and I observed some master classes and classes with her other alumni, and I was really quite surprised to realize how much of her teaching is in my teaching.
Oh, interesting.
Because my most recent memories are more of the audition preparatory, you know, training that I received at Carnegie Mellon. So I sort of thought that that was really the bedrock, but it's more a blend of all of it.
Kind
And I
of in the
also
same way that as you get older, you realize that the things that are coming out of your mouth are the things that your parents said when you were a kid.
For real. I mean, like I said, you know, the sorry kids, how about your older sister watches you for a while? I've got some notes learned that is being replicated
Yeah.
on a daily basis.
And
I
yeah, the
think
same thing happens with your pedagogical lineage too, not just your biological.
yeah, and I think, I mean, it all gets filtered and kind of modernized.
Yeah.
The ways that people learned in the past, I think, contained a little bit higher ratio of tough love.
Absolutely.
We understand the importance of, you know, whole student learning and, of course, mental health. Whereas at some conservatories, I think, maybe before our time, but maybe also into our time, there was a sense that, like, that's just the way it is. That's just the pressure. And if you can't handle it, you probably shouldn't do this. Or even a sort of performative element to pushing yourself to the limit.
And also, I think there's been a sense of, well, it was bad for me, and so of course it has to be bad for everybody else who comes after me too.
I hope that's not the way that people think anymore.
I think that changed.
I think that might have been the way it was for our teachers or their teachers. I do think sometimes in my own teaching that I feel like I'm having to really work hard to soft pedal. And I don't always know if it's in the student's interest to be quite so, you know, that's just not also the truth.
And it's interesting. I mean, so I'd like to dive into this a little bit more and talk about your current teaching and how you've gotten there, but it reminds me of a teaching evaluation I got last year where there were a couple of students who very specifically mentioned they wished that I had been harder on them and that they were capable of taking more. And it's a really tough balance to find. So tell us more about your teaching today and where do you teach? What kinds of students do you teach? And how do you approach all of them?
I teach at Roosevelt University in Chicago at the Chicago College of the Performing Arts, and there I'm teaching currently, adding to the existing students' lesson load with piccolo specific instruction, which is supplemental to their private lessons with their primary teachers. And then I also teach at Carthage College in Kenosha, and I have my own studio of both music performance and music education majors there. Those are all undergraduates currently, and it's a good blend for me. I really enjoy working with the master's students at CCPA in Chicago because it's more, you know, you can go a little farther with the detail and the nuance of what you're describing, and also their ability to respond to those instructions is a little more. It's closer to my own experience. You know, we can talk to each other about things and understand each other very quickly. But I've learned a lot from working with the undergraduates at Carthage, especially some of the music ed majors, because as I said, I don't have a ton of experience with things like embouchure changes or like really unconventional hand position. things that when I see it, I'm just like, well, yeah, you just have to fix that. But they don't know how to fix it. It's normal to them, and they want me to tell them how to fix it. So that's an area where we're kind of figuring it out together, and hoping for the best. And so far we've had, you know, no grave outcomes. But I think if we're talking about like the balance between pressure and support in a teaching environment, I think it's always really the student that's leading those decisions as a teacher. And, you know, having a really uniform approach to the curriculum is helpful as a teacher, so you can keep track of what's going on, and everybody's kind of got a baseline for you know, sound and technique and things like that. But not everybody can learn at the same pace. Not everybody can learn with the same type of feedback. And I think students that do want more, whether pressure is the right word or not, I wish there was a different word.
I know.
I'm sure in German there are like five different words for it.
Right. And but I mean, I think it's critical. It's critical to feel some urgency about the learning process, and responsibility to do your best, because I think that's the way that you, the point for me in many of the lessons is not perfecting, you know, the passage. It's more like figuring out how to control your mind and your response to stimulus so that you can complete this task, and how does that relate to other things in your life? Because if you can understand how to work out a difficult, you know, technical section without getting frustrated and flooded and anxious and angry and quitting and making excuses, it's just a tiny thing where there are no like really serious consequences if it doesn't go well. So in a way that can remove the pressure.
Yeah.
But it can teach you like a way to center your reactions that we need all the time in the real world.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that I'm great at that in the real world.
But that's why we practice.
Well, I think for students who are not going to be performers, which most of them probably won't be professional performers full time, that's what I want them to get. Really, I want them to enjoy making music. I want them to be as proficient as they can on their instruments for their own satisfaction. And if they do want to be performers, then, you know, then we have to go into a different zone of, if not criticism, critique and critical thinking.
And accountability too.
And accountability and motivation.
Yes.
But I think for the ones who are not seeking a performing career, the main benefit of studying music is that self-discovery and learning about the learning process. So I don't know if that requires pressure. I think sometimes students interpret critical thinking as pressure. And I think that's also important to understand, is the difference between like analyzing a problem so that you can solve it versus placing blame on the person who's experiencing the problem.
Right.
You know, like if you're in this, you can't play this section. I'm not blaming you for that. I'm not telling you that you're not a valuable human and shame on you or any of those things. I'm identifying this fact and saying like, there's a way through, there's a way forward. So it's also important for a student to understand that we can talk about, you know, problems without it being shameful and embarrassing and blaming and, you know, like that can be a way to solve the problem if you just don't identify with it.
Right.
So I think that's what I'm hoping my students take beyond the flute specific, you know, vibrato and like core sound and the really instrumental skills.
Right.
I think the human skills.
Yeah.
The human skills are the ones that I care the most about.
Hmm.
And then for the ones who do want to be performers, I mean, there's so much of that you can then bring back into focus when you're in an audition or you're in a recital setting and there's a lot of perceived pressure for your performance to be accurate and sparkling and inspired and all of this stuff. Like understanding that this is really just a microcosm of your worldview.
Right.
And that there's more to you than that moment.
Yeah. And also, I think within that, there's also the hope that the students we send out who will become performers will have this, you know, this mindset that then will help shape the industry itself into a place that is more thoughtful and, you know, can fix problems instead of placing blame and things like that. Let's dive into some of these kind of bigger questions, because I feel like that's kind of where this conversation is going anyway. Part of the reason that we're having this conversation is because you jumped at the chance to participate in this idea of like what is the intersection of the arts and education and public policy and social justice, and how, like, what is our role as musicians, as teachers, in a world where it seems like so many things are falling apart, and so many people are facing challenges that, quite frankly, you and I are so privileged we will never experience a fraction of that. How does what we do make the world a better place? Besides the fact of everything that you just talked about, where, we're equipping students and people to be better humans, right? So, just with that as a baseline.
Yeah, I mean, that's also that it's obviously it's super privileged. Like you aren't going to be studying the flute or the viola or any instrument in music school if there is food insecurity. So we have to acknowledge that. Whatever ideas we have about, figuring out how to play G sharp minor scale, making it easier to, come up with the rent. I don't, I, it doesn't, it's not a direct correlation, but I do think we can't set ourselves apart from these questions, even though it seems like the place we're observing the problems from is a very privileged and elite one. I think it would be more privileged and elite to say, well, it's only music and we're just going to keep playing music all the time, and not consider the context that we're doing that in. It's not always apparent to the audiences what the reason for a certain program may be or what the connection between pieces and composers is with the present moment or the current events going on. But I think that the intention, my intention, whenever I have the ability to choose what music I'm playing or the situation that I'm performing in, my intention is always to make those choices with some awareness of what do I actually want to say? Like, what do I want to say about the world right now? And what do I want to, it's not that I want to remind people of something, like I have, the authority to do that, but what do I want to emphasize? And that's for my experience and my feeling of meaning and relevance in making music, but also I think sometimes those connections can be, if not more direct, like they can affect people in a way that like a direct conversation might not. So I think that of course we have to be cons we have to consider in our programming like whether we're continuing to promote biases and overlook groups of composers and people whose music should be heard. So I think that that's an obvious part that has started to change. But I think in terms of making music right now, we talked about this right after the election. So it seems obvious that that's where this is coming from. All these crises that we've experienced in recent memory, COVID and Black Lives Matter and these elections and school shootings and housing instability and just the climate. Like there is a lot that is an urgent need for people that playing a flute recital is going to do nothing about. But there's also a feeling that there are a lot of things I could do with my life that would be making things worse. And I think that music is not one of those things. And I think that when we are faced with a world that is so overwhelming in the critical needs that people are facing, and we don't feel like we can do anything. Like, what am I going to do? There's a guy living under the bridge over there, and I took him a blanket, and I took him some coffee, and I took him some food, and I don't have the skills or the expertise to really make change. Whether it's individuals responding to things that they see in their community or getting involved in larger citizen groups, I think we all have to consider what we can do and do that. And what I can do is play the flute. And so I'm not going to consider that anytime I play the flute is just for me and having fun and was just as great, but I'm trying to make sure that when I choose to perform outside of, my responsibilities to the orchestra, that there's a context and there is, if not a message, an intention to heighten awareness in some regard for some of these issues, and that audiences can respond to that without feeling scolded or that they're sort of just being in, this is being inflicted upon them. I'm going to make you listen to this new music that you didn't want to hear in the first place, and I'm going to tell you why you should like it. It doesn't have to be that way. I think that there is a lot of openness, actually, and it all has to do with how we try to make those connections and whether we are considering the recipient of our gestures to be have good intentions. Like if you just assume that people don't want to hear things or that they're not ready or they're on the other side and we will never meet, yeah, then we'll never cross over.
One of the beautiful things about being a musician, and this might sound super obvious, but the fact that we have an audience. I mean, everybody has an audience to a certain extent, right? Like everybody has their sphere of influence. Anybody can start a social media page, anybody, but people actually choose to spend their time with us as an audience. And as you were talking, it struck me how that in and of itself is a pretty fantastic gift and opportunity that not everybody has.
Right. How often do you go out and not look at a phone with a bunch of people that you don't know? I mean, never. Like, I see my students in the common areas at the colleges, and they're all on their phones. They're not, like, I'm thinking, like, how are you flirting with each other? Like, aren't you supposed to be flirting? Probably they're texting each other. I mean, like, I feel like the human connection is at a low point. So that's what's valuable about live
Absolutely.
music. Whether that includes, talking and connecting with the audiences and trying to make this more of an approachable experience, giving context to the pieces or not. They're together. It's
The shared
and no
human
one's asking
experience,
each
right?
other, like, do we have this in common? Are we on the same side of this or that? It's everyone is there. And they're having that experience at the same time in the present moment. And that's the other thing that I think is extremely valuable about live, all the arts, versus, of course, there's a lot of value in recorded music and recorded, film and theater and all of these things as well. But it happens right now, and that's another thing that students get to begin to understand is this present moment experience of life, which is very hard to have in the virtual age, I think. That there's value to something that happens and passes versus, I can look that up anytime. I don't have to listen to the Goldberg Variations now because Glenn Gold recorded it, and I can listen to it anytime. I'm so glad he did. The only thing that got my daughter to bed last night. But it's just there's a really different, and the other thing about that is sometimes I think as performers we feel that we don't get to perform something that's been recorded by the most incredible performer ever. Like once that's been done, we should never play it because we're not at that level or we're not that person. I just played a recital with a colleague and he asked me to play a piece that I felt very, very insecure about. Because one of my teachers had recorded it and it was basically like, well, that's
The
done
same
now.
thing,
No one can ever do that again. And then I thought, I was like, well, they probably close mic'd her and everything was pr balanced in the studio
totally.
and she got to go through and like patch things. But my students would hear me practicing And they didn't even know the piece. And they'd say, well, that's a really cool piece. So I decided to just, with the staff accompanist, just play it for them. Because otherwise, if I told them to listen to it online, they wouldn't.
No.
So studio class that week was me getting a dry run of the recital I had to play the week later,
Nice.
and forcing them to sit there for 25 minutes and listen to a flute sonata, because that's also a skill that we don't practice.
No, attention span, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Yeah,
So.
that reminds me, I just the other day I saw a video of Billie Eilish talking about the recording process, and she and her brother were showing the track that had been recorded, and just like literally how many takes it took to produce this thing. And it was like every 3 seconds it had been spliced in from a different take. And anybody who's been through a recording session understands that, like, yeah, the finished product is nowhere near what you get in a live performance. And so part of the magic of a live performance is also dealing with making mistakes and how do you recover from mistakes. And because that's also a life skill, is understanding that, like, things aren't always, rarely actually going to go according to plan. And there has to be some kind of real-time recovery and not just a complete falling apart. And I think, I mean, and this is just kind of me on my little soapbox here, but in this world where everything that we see in the media is so sanitized and produced and perfected and photo, like everything, like it's so perfected, but that's not life. That's not life. If you, this will be a fun question. If you were in charge, if you, pick a position, whether it's like dean of a music conservatory or president of an orchestra or, president of an entire association of schools or orchestras or conservatories or, I don't know, master of the universe, whatever. What changes would you implement in our industry? Where do we need to grow? Where do we need to change?
I mean, I feel like there are really good efforts being made. Someone just emailed me a posting for a job at I think it was University of Colorado, which was a director of musician wellness.
Ooh.
And it was an awesome job description. It was for someone who had a master's degree in music and also some kind of specialty in either psychotherapy or Alexander technique or yoga or physical therapy or, Zen Buddhism or something.
Yeah.
Probably could have been, religion. It could have been anything that would have been kind of whole person supplemental to just this musician track of a performing degree. So I think that there is a lot of awareness of the limitations of previous training programs. I think it's kind of impossible to synthesize all the things that you need to know to be a performer and to provide that in 2 years or 4 years. Life skills, like none of us had those.
No.
We took out vast amounts of student debt, which we didn't have any realistic expectation of paying off for many people. It wasn't clear like how that would affect their lives, into, home ownership and whether or not to have kids, and all kinds of choices were made because of that choice. And it wasn't explained. I mean, and I don't even know if it had been explained if it would have changed my own decision, because I just had one focus and that was music. But
But at least if it had been explained, maybe there would have been fewer surprises.
I probably would have ignored them if I'm honest. I probably said whatever. But I don't think that I also think, the teachers who tried, even in my own education, to explain the need to be an educator as well as a performer, or, to have a the freelance mentality or have other skills outside of auditioning and orchestral flute playing,
Yeah.
that was seen as hedging your bets in a way that would limit your ability to be successful.
Right.
And now I think it's actually a critical part of everyone's life, you know, including people who do make it into an orchestra if that's what they want. You know, there's a lot more to a satisfying career in music than just crossing over that obstacle.
Right.
And even once you have the job, like how do you stay interested? It's a relationship. It's not just a job. It's not just a passion. It's not just an outlet. It's a whole relationship. It's more like, I think, even like a life relationship, like a marriage or something, where you have to kind of find revitalization and stay committed and not let things get stale and all of the stuff. When I made my Vivaldi recording, I had no clue all of the things that would go into hiring musicians, you know, figuring out the recording process, recording label, distribution, like any of the stuff that I learned in the process. Like I had not been exposed to that sequence of events or any expectation of what was a reasonable budget or time frame or any of the necessary pieces of knowledge for accomplishing a project like that. Now I do, but I would have loved to have had like a music business over. I'm sure lots of colleges and conservatories offer that now.
Starting to become more widespread, yeah.
But I think the perception that we can only do one thing
Yes.
is really not accurate. I think we were told, or at least I was told, and I believed that if I diversified at all, I would just be like stepping off of this extremely narrow tightrope. And I think, in fact, maybe the lane was wider than I realized, and anything that I could bring into my experience of music and life would have been just a benefit. Improvisation, you know, like playing other styles of music, like all of that can seem like a distraction. And there are certainly some students who are just like so diversified and branched out. Like, okay, we
Need
need a
to
little more.
focus a little bit.
So that, you know, again, it's really individual. That's why I think it's hard. It must be incredibly hard to design guidelines because it's always changing too. I mean, our perception of history is always changing, and who to include and what to say about it, and should we ever play Wagner? I mean, you know, there's just a very shifty perspective on a lot of things.
Then, of course, with any of this, whether it's making big changes at a university or making big changes within an orchestra, there are so many diverse stakeholders that have to get on board in order to make any of these changes happen. You know, at a university, you've got tenured faculty who are wanting to protect, you know, their interests, and in an orchestra, I mean, flute players think differently than viola players do. I
Of
mean,
course.
you know, and anybody who's been through a conductor search knows that different members of an orchestra can think very differently about who's on the podium, much less the repertoire that you're playing, or, you know, any other things that go into running a professional orchestra. And I think that's a big part of the reason why all of this seems to move at a glacial pace sometimes is just because of the way the systems are set up, and unless we want some kind of a dictatorship, which I don't think any of us want in any of these organizations, progress does come slowly because it requires changing hearts and minds of a lot of people who have a lot of different perspectives.
Yeah, you know, I also think we sometimes assume that people who are non-musicians, like whether it's, you know, board members of an orchestra or board members of a school board, won't get it. Or we just like are so used to being undervalued that we think we're fighting an uphill battle, even if we might not be. So I think that I'm looking at my phone right now because I just there was a quote that I heard from this incredible documentary. I'm going to just have to repeat it without attributing it. But recently, my children go to a school where they didn't have any opportunity to learn an orchestral or a band instrument. Mm. There were no like adolescent band, orchestra, choral ensembles.
Okay.
There was a general music teacher, and that was it for like 700 kids. And the parents at my kids' school are fairly attentive and, you know, arts minded. So we started, you know, trying to figure out like, okay, based on like the district requirements, well, we should have this and we should be able to have, you know, our mm-hmm. size school of our size should support these ensemble opportunities. And the more we dug into this, we realized that the reason that we weren't being allocated that music educator was not based on funding and not based on the district requirements, but it was because in a large municipal school district, like there were so many schools that didn't have music teachers at all.
Oh.
And they had the funding to do it. Again, they had the will to hire those teachers. Like this was kind of a building back after a lot of cuts.
Sure.
They were motivated to fill these vacancies, but at a lot of these schools in other parts of the city, there just were no applicants. So there were no teachers being hired. So these kids had no music access. So it wouldn't have been equitable to hire an orchestra teacher for my kids' school at the same time that these other schools had no music education whatsoever.
Yeah.
So we sort of shifted our focus away from, well, we want an orchestra director to, we should fill all these vacancies.
Yeah.
And we were able to go to a board meeting for the school board and testify before the school board, and there had been so much like advanced groundwork, ground game done by one member of the music parents committee, just like heroic efforts to call people and talk to people and understand this very like linguistically gnarly description of what was specifically prescribed for each population level and each funding level within the school district. And we went to the school board and we thought like, they're not going to do this. They're not going to revise the music curriculum. They're not going to hire these teachers, but we're just going to go and we're going to try. And in fact, there was also a contingent of music educators that were there to testify against us because they thought that we were asking them to do more work. That we were asking them to, you know, if they were a general music teacher, also teach orchestra or also teach band. And it was really transformative because in the course of the meeting, we were able to not only convince some of the board members of the importance of having early childhood education for the arts, but also the importance of an instrumental ensemble or a choral ensemble for adolescents, both as a precursor for high school, but also just because at that age, like any outlet that is not a phone is crucial. I mean, not every kid's going to play sports. Like this team experience of doing something together is rarer and rarer.
Yes.
Kids don't play outside together.
Nope.
They don't do anything together, but they could be in band sounding like garbage together.
Yeah.
So then after all of the parents had spoken and the music educators had spoken, then a few of the music educators got back up and they said, no, in fact, they're right. It's not because we made clear, like, it's not that we want the general music teachers to teach band. We actually think that these skills are so specific and important that we need specialists in each of these fields. And I don't want to say we succeeded because it's a work in progress. They're still having to hire these teachers, but we do have an orchestra teacher at my daughter's school now.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of these other schools are starting to fill those vacancies for general music and, upper elementary and adolescent music educators ensembles. So that was an amazing experience for me because I think there was a perception even among the music parents that I was going to go there and I was going to be, you know, thinking about orchestral training and it would be totally irrelevant to what we were trying to achieve. And I remembered the guy is Max Roach, the person who said this. He was a drummer for Miles Davis and he was one of the most outstanding jazz drummers in history. And people, you know, he got involved in the civil rights era, of course, and like, you know, being very vocal. And, using his music to make a specific impact on society and express certain things. But he said that as a child and as a teen, especially, that if he hadn't turned to music, he would have turned to guns.
Yeah.
Because of the frustration and the oppression that he felt in his world, that there was no outlet for that.
Yeah.
And for me, that is the number one reason why we have to continue to teach kids how to play instruments. Not because it'll reduce school violence, but I do think it will.
Yeah.
And I think when you have some way to deal with your emotions, whether it's positive or negative, like, this is what we need. That's what I needed after the election. Like, I didn't, there was nothing I could do. There was nothing I could do to change anything about the world, but I could play Bach.
Yep.
And I could try to make my students understand that when they play Bach or they play music from a perspective of life that is so distant from their own, they're actually sharing something very fundamental with like their ancient, you know, ancestors or relatives from the past, you know, that we have an experience of pain and joy and life that we can relate to over time through this ritual of playing music.
Yeah.
And it's a way to understand each other. So I think that doesn't answer your question at all. There's nothing that I would even change or say about how to make things better, but I would probably just say, get off your phone and
and go make some music.
Go make some awful sounds on a trumpet somewhere. Like, I don't know. I don't know.
I love that. I love that.
So that's where I would take things, I guess. And also that not everyone who thinks differently than you will always think differently than you. You know, like, I think we are especially now at a point where we think that, you know, the doors are closed.
Yeah.
We can't see the good in each other anymore. And I think it's a good way to remember, without hashing things out, that we have something in common.
Yeah. I think that's as good of a place as any to wrap up. Do you feel like there's anything else that you were hoping to talk about or really want to talk about that you want to
take? No, except that I'm so excited about this project that you've started. Thank you so much for asking me to do this.
This was so delightful, and it's
really
great
fun
to learn more about you and to have these conversations. And right now it's just a little seedling, and it's interesting to see where it's going to grow. To learn more about Jenny, visit her website at jenniferboutonflute.com. That's JenniferBoutonFlute.com. I would love to hear your thoughts on the conversation that I had with Jenny today. Send me an email at nicole@zirconarts.com. Thanks so much for being with us today, and I look forward to next time.